Hello, and welcome to a special edition of the Reason podcast in which we are going to talk about abortion. I am joined today by two of my colleagues, Reason Managing Editor Stephanie Slade and Reason Associate Editor Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
So we decided that it would be a good idea to just bring some of the ladies of Reason together, who also represent some of the farther ends of our abortion views spectrum, because there's a lot of interesting news right now about abortion. In particular, on Tuesday last week, the Georgia governor signed into law a heartbeat bill, which effectively bans abortion after 6 weeks. There was a similar bill in Alabama, and there are a few others wending their way through different state legislatures. So I guess I just wanted to start with a quick discussion, maybe a meta discussion about the coverage of these bills. So there's been some very, very strong language and some very, very strong opinions about what these bills mean, both for women and kind of more broadly for the politics of abortion in the United States. Slade, what do you make of some of the headlines, and have you found them broadly to be accurate?
Abortion is always a complicated issue, and this is a complicated piece of legislation. So not surprisingly, the coverage has not been super great or clear. I mean, there's been a lot of hand-wringing and breathless commentary and some stuff that a lot of the headlines, for example, have said things like women could get the death penalty for having an abortion, which you really have to torture the language of the bill to come to that conclusion, because what it actually says is that an illegal abortion, and it lays out what is meant in the state of Georgia now by that term, could result in, you know, between 1 and 10 years of in prison. That's what the bill says. But the bill also says that for the purposes of Georgia law, unborn children with a heartbeat now count as people in Georgia. And so some commentators are saying, well, if you can get the death penalty for murder in Georgia, then you can get the death penalty for abortion in Georgia, even though the text of the legislation specifies 1 to 10 years in prison as the actual, you know, punishment for the crime being laid out.
So there's definitely a little bit of hysteria. But on the other hand, Liz, this bill is a very, very significant change from existing law, and is explicitly structured as a challenge to Roe v. Wade. Can you kind of talk about how it fits in the broader legal landscape and why the bill is the shape that it is right now?
Yeah. I mean, just to follow up on what Slade was saying about the media coverage, it was even worse. I mean, yeah, the death penalty thing, you also saw people saying that women who cross state lines to get abortions could still be face criminal penalties in Georgia, as if Georgia's going to, you know, set up like a guard to give people some sort of, you know, abortion test at the borders or something. So that was all pretty nuts. But that's sort of par for the course when it comes to any sort of coverage of abortion restrictions, and any sort of reaction to it from Democrats in the left or just, you know, pro-choice people in general. And I think that that's really a shame, because they've been doing that so much for just about everything over the past, you know, however many years. Like, even things that are totally pro-choice, like, you know, making birth control over the counter, somehow that was twisted because it was, you know, might have messed with Obamacare. That was twisted into being a huge anti-choice Handmaid's Tale thing. And that's bad because it's created a boy who cried wolf sort of situation, or women who cried wolf, because, you know, this is, like you said, this is very different. These heartbeat bills that we're seeing, you know, they ban abortion at 6 weeks gestational age, which, you know, a lot of men might not know this, but that actually is about 2 weeks after conception, because of the way that pregnancy is measured from the start date of a woman's last period before they conceive. So, you know, 2 weeks conception, people who don't have regular periods, they might be even, you know, not even know they're pregnant at that time. It's effectively a ban on, you know, almost all abortion. And prior to this point, what we've seen the strategy be for people who are fighting for abortion restrictions is to focus on either the margins, like, you know, 20, you know, right now it's 20 weeks is viability, you know, but pushback. OK, well, actually, it should be banned at 20 weeks. Or we've seen sort of these ancillary things that they called trap laws, like targeted restriction of abortion providers, which was, you know, really picky things about how wide the hallways are and who has what licenses and all that sort of stuff, to try and sort of backdoor, you know, ban abortion through, you know, death by 1,000 regulations. But these new laws are really a sort of different kind of breed, because with the different makeup at the Supreme Court now, I mean, you're seeing the anti-abortion activists sort of deliberately say all the time that this is their new strategy. They want to have constitutional challenges because they think it's a good time to go to the Supreme Court.
And in fact, we've had politicians in some of these states saying, we know that this law, as it is written, is currently viewed by the Supreme Court, within Supreme Court precedent, as unconstitutional. That's the point.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think, that's a piece that maybe we could talk a little bit about, a debate that's always lurking below any abortion debate, which is Roe v. Wade and whether it was rightly or wrongly decided, both from the point of view of the consequences of Roe v. Wade. Like, I think there is a, to me, quite a plausible narrative that the way that Roe v. Wade was decided created the polarized abortion system abortion debate that we have now, that it sort of pushed people into two very distinct camps and kept them there. But there's, I think, also a case to be made that if you feel very strongly on either side of the issue, Roe v. Wade was unsatisfactory, that it created a system where you were always going to have these fights at the margin. You are always going to be pushing the date of viability up or down. You are always going to be fighting about restrictions because it still did leave power in the hands of the states, but not enough to definitively rule one way or the other. Do you think that's a fair characterization, Slade?
Well, I was actually thinking about an interesting tidbit in a recent feature from Reason editor Damon Root. He wrote a few months ago about the career of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and pointed out that she was actually an early critic of Roe v. Wade, even though she's obviously strongly pro-choice. She said that it was sort of a overly heavy-handed decision because it basically wiped all state regulations off the books, whereas this was many years ago, she said, before she was a Supreme Court justice, that was a problem because some of the state regulations were more problematic than others legally. And by sort of doing this blanket approach of just top-down Supreme Court wiping the books clean, it sort of aroused states' rights resistance in a way that it might not have if they had just sort of targeted the really, from her perspective, the really egregious or the most egregious restrictions on abortion at the state level, and that's really fomented a lot of and lasting opposition. And this is now almost the reverse of that. You have now individual states saying we're going to be the test case to see if we can't, we're going to intentionally and sort of blatantly pass state laws that are contrary to the precedent set by the Supreme Court under Roe v. Wade and Casey and subsequent case law, and see if, we have a new court now. Let's see if the decisions that get handed down are different.
And what that does essentially is it creates a situation where all the players have agreed that the only people that matter are the Supreme Court justices, right? I mean, it's that essentially, rather than doing something that brings the debate closer to the individual level or the local level, where we say, okay, listen, let's have state legislatures fight this out, figure this out, let's let people's elected representatives try to come to consensus or compromise based on the views of their constituents. We have instead just an all-in strategy in which you go to the court. And of course, that has led to, I think, the super, super polarized situation that you get in Washington every time there's a Supreme Court nomination, because people rightly believe this person could be the person who decides whether or not abortion is legal. And people feel very strongly about it.
But on the other hand, I would love Liz to weigh on this, because on the other hand, even as the politics are pushing towards the highest level and it's all about the Supreme Court, science is progressing in a way that is sort of almost making the laws moot in some cases, right? I mean, women can self-terminate if they catch the pregnancy early enough.
Right. So let's talk about that specifically with reference to Georgia, because the Georgia bill and other bills like it are written very explicitly not to punish the woman. The woman who has the abortion, is her behavior is not criminalized. What's criminalized is the person who performs the abortion.
Is that explicit in the Georgia bill?
Well, it actually says that she has the right to collect
sue,
damages
yeah.
from the provider. So
right.
It's treating the woman as the victim.
And this is, I think, this intersects with your other beats in an interesting
yeah.
way, where like it's very clearly going to create a situation because of the abortion pill and also because of the potential for traveling in and out of state lines, where there will be some people who are technically classed as victims who will almost certainly suffer as perpetrators but through sort of secondhand or backdoor enforcement mechanisms, right? So they'll be investigated even if they're not charged, or they'll be.
Talk about how,
you know, what it means to kind of make the abortion provider the criminal, and what it means when you can be your own abortion provider.
I think it creates a big legal mess, first of all. I mean, yeah, because as you just said, that's a very strange paradox that we haven't yet had to address really in courts, and we will. But I think the biggest thing is that, you know, yeah, for the long time, there was the coat hanger, right, as the symbol of illegal abortion. And that's obvious. That's so not the case anymore. Even there was a piece at Salon this week from Amanda Marcotte, who's, you know, one of the most sort of progressive Democrat feminists writing about this. And she was arguing against the idea of the coat hanger abortion because, like, that's not what's happening anymore. People can pretty easily get abortion pills, which is just a two-pill process, from internet pharmacies abroad and have them, you know, mailed to their homes and take them. And, you know, it's a very safe procedure and everything. There's not really the requirement of a doctor. There's much less likelihood that we're going to see things like, you know, women massively bleeding out because they've tried to perform an illegal abortion. But I think that creates, like you said, a whole new realm of potential for surveillance and application of laws that people love to, you know, sort of use in women's bodies across the board. And I'm thinking of like prostitution laws, like the Mann Act, but, you know, which prevents, you know, crossing lines for immoral purposes. And so, like, there's ways that could be maybe defined to do something like that, or using interstate commerce, like things involving the Commerce Clause, things involving Section 230, which is a big fight right now, which is, you know, protects internet providers, certain content platforms from being held liable for things that their users do. But what if they, you know, what if they sell this abortion drug illegally? So I think that there's all these areas that people haven't considered that this will really, you know, because of the scientific realities these days, that this will really affect. And just one last thing too, is that, I mean, I think that creates a whole new, and this is obviously not just, if this is just in Georgia, that's different. But if this starts to be, you know, a thing across the country, or if it would be federal, it creates a whole new drug war, right? I mean, it creates a whole new task force of surveillance, you know, crews and teams that have to try and, you know, get rid of, you know, illegal abortion providers, see if they're finding these pills. So outside of just, I mean, and there's obviously a lot of horrible effects for individual women who, you know, are subject to this. But I think there's a lot of these huge legal and social things, too, that we haven't thought about.
And yet, without putting words in your mouth, I think someone who is pro-life, as you describe yourself, Slade, would say, like, yeah, listen, there are going to be some negative effects for enforcement. But if you think that the cost more broadly is human life, then we just have to figure out how to mitigate those costs. Like, is that a fair characterization? And if it's not, what am I saying wrong? Since I should say, cards on the table, though I am the moderator in this debate, I also lean significantly in the pro-choice direction for many of the reasons that Liz just described. So I will do my best to be fair, but I want you to correct me if I say something that sounds not true to your beliefs.
Well, one response is basically what you just said, which is, you know, our criminal justice system, which is certainly flawed in many ways, and we spent a lot of time writing about that here at Reason, but the criminal justice system is set up to, for example, investigate and have due process and differentiate between, for example, criminal homicide and accidental death. And so, although I think reasonable to raise the possibility that if abortion is criminalized at an early stage in pregnancy, that a woman who has a miscarriage might, you know, somehow get pulled into the criminal justice system because of questions about whether she, you know, obtained an illegal abortion or something like that, and that's troubling for, especially, you know, for us as civil libertarians, that the system is supposed to, the criminal justice system is explicitly and specifically created to try to answer these types of questions. And so to throw our hands up and say, like, well, we'll never be able to tell the difference between somebody who has broken the law and somebody hasn't, and so we shouldn't have a law in the first place, sort of runs against the, you know, justification and the reasoning for all laws against things like murder.
But what makes this different than other crimes where we're talking about, yes, like innocent people do get investigated for other crimes, but the crime scene is not their body. And, you know, investigating the forensic, you know, criminal forensics is not involved, like, you know, inserting things in their vagina and doing all sorts of invasive things. So I think that really sort of changes the terms of this, because you do have, you know, you're talking about very invasive investigation of women's who may have just lost the pregnancy that they very much wanted. And I think that that emotionally, rightfully so, just, you know, really affects people, because if anyone who, I mean, anyone who has lost a pregnancy or known someone has that they wanted, it's very traumatic. And to think that you were putting them through this is, I think that's why people think about it differently.
I wonder if there's also something to talk about here on the kind of question of whether this is the place we would end up with as an actual legal standard. So like abortion at 6 weeks, like the reason that these laws have been written in this way is to maximize the efficacy of a challenge that finds its way up to the Supreme Court, right? So it's not at all clear to me that the place we would end up is something that looks like the Georgia bill. We could easily end up in a place that looks like something south of Roe v. Wade and north of the Georgia bill. And so I think, you know, one question that comes to my mind is like, the way that we arbitrate those distinctions is so shaped by our court system and by, in particular, the Supreme Court challenge system, in which there needs to be disagreement between lower courts that the Supreme Court can then resolve. So I wonder, like, from both of your perspectives as sort of watchers of this issue, you know, it seems to me very unlikely, just given the general views about abortion held in this country broadly, that the place we end up is most states with a level of restriction that is currently being proposed in Georgia. And so then, you know, one question I think that's interesting for libertarians is it okay to say, listen, you still have abortion rights if you have to travel to exercise them? So I guess I'm interested in what you guys think about that question, or vice versa. Listen, if abortion is murder or something akin to it, how do we feel about, like, murder is legal in Michigan and illegal in Georgia?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a reasonable position, and that it should be. I mean, it wouldn't be bad if I was in one of those states where it was, you know, banned. Like, I would think activists in those states and maybe activists across the country should still be fighting to get it legal there. But I don't think that, that's, you know, necessarily a horrible anti-libertarian position to say that, you know, federalism is cool here like it is with other things. But, you know, what you were talking about, it's not going to be this total ban across the country kind of thing. I think you're totally right. And one of the terrible things about this way, we've talked about it, where everything is so polarizing and we're all just focused on the judges and blah, 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 is that everybody always talks about the most, you know, scenarios on either side. It's either like a woman who's just like, I'm 30 weeks pregnant and I'm going to have an abortion, or someone who was like, you know, raped by their brother and needs an abortion at 3 weeks and can't get one because it's, you know, Gilead. And so I feel like we argue at these polls so much that we do forget that there's so much middle ground that a lot of Americans agree on when it comes to this.
Slade, what do you think about the federalism point?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have the same position as Liz, but sort of inverted, which is that, like, of course, I think that abortion is wrong in virtually every case, and I would like to see it someday be illegal everywhere. That's like ultimately what would be an ideal for me based on my, like, my priors, my moral and, you know, philosophical priors here. But that is not a thing that the position that I have sort of staked out as Reason's pro-life libertarian is that it's really important to start with cultural change on this, and what matters is, and public opinion is really important, more so than legal change. So if you just ban something, or if you, you know, wipe the bans off the books as Roe v. Wade did, sort of a top down, one size fits all, you go against what the prevailing opinions are in various parts of the country. It's a big country. You're not going to be successful in the end at accomplishing the thing that you are trying to accomplish. Again, whether you're on the other side and you think that, like, Roe v. Wade was a huge, you know, achievement for the women's autonomy, or whether you're on my side and hoping someday to get to a point where abortion is basically non-existent. It can't just be me or the president or the Supreme Court deciding on behalf of everyone. You kind of have to have an organic cultural change. And as sort of pro-life activists, I think increasingly have understood over the years, I mean, changing hearts and minds is incredibly important. I mean, right now we're actually sort of seeing this a reversal on that. I think for a long time, the pro-life movement thought Roe v. Wade is on the books. It's very unlikely that that's going to change. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a lot more just like activism aimed at trying to convince people that this is immoral and they should change their view of it, you know, again, at a cultural change level. Right now, I think there has been a sense that, well, okay, maybe that first thing about Roe v. Wade is sort of in cement and it's not going anywhere. Maybe it's not quite as true as it once was, as what we once thought it was. And so we're going to try pushing on the legal levers a little more than we have lately. And I mean, that's fine, I guess. I really do come back to trying to change the law, especially in a place where the public isn't with you, or trying to change the law to an extent where you've gone beyond where the public opinion in that place is probably creating more problems. I mean,
right, because it's kind of like we're saying, there's a difference between someone, and again, you know, not for the situation, but there's a difference between someone is suspected, an individual suspected of having an illegal abortion, and they have to investigate that sporadically, versus if these bans are passed and everybody is still just accessing abortion pills. You know, that's what creates like the giant intrusive police state arm of this, if you don't
get closer to an analogy to the drug war, which I think is very interesting in this context, right? If everyone agreed that doing drugs was bad, the shape of the drug war would be very different. And in fact, there's an interesting hypocrisy at work with many types of drugs, at least, where people think doing drugs should be illegal broadly, but themselves sometimes do drugs or have done drugs. And so I wonder, in the circumstance of abortion, like that something very similar to that might obtain, that you might broadly say, listen, abortion should be avoided at all costs. This is not like a moral good. It's, you know, it's something that we should, you know, seek to minimize. But when I'm pregnant and I don't want to be pregnant, I am willing to make an exception for myself. So I guess I wonder also,
you know, quite a few people.
Sure.
Like that.
And this happens. You know, it happens in both directions, right? It also happens that people who are very, very staunchly pro-choice, who would have said that they would have an abortion, look at the ultrasound and change their mind. Right. And so I guess I'm interested in the theory of cultural change. What does it look like when the culture changes to a thing that cultures often do, which is like a lightly hypocritical or sort of a and not a confused view on the matter?
I'm not sure that that's actually a sustainable position. I mean, I think that the sort of example of pot legalization has shown us that at some point you hit a tipping, you sort of get to the tipping point where enough people have stopped seeing this as being sort of deeply morally problematic. And suddenly the entire justification for the legal regime around it starts to collapse. So I don't know if abortion is analogous, but that's sort of, I tend to think that, I mean, I just am a believer that law follows culture, that, you know, as we often say, politics is a lagging indicator. If public opinion changes dramatically on something, the laws inevitably, and sometimes even Supreme Court decisions that will just completely reverse themselves. It's a really hilarious thing that we seem to believe that we live in a country that's bound by the Constitution, which is this unmoving document, and that, you know, previous case law is binding. And I don't think that's actually been shown to be the case at all. So I always use the example of gay marriage in 2012, in like March-ish of 2012, support, according to Gallup polling, for gay marriage crossed the 50% threshold. And almost immediately, Obama evolved on that issue. I love that. It was like within a matter of weeks, he suddenly came out and had this moral evolution where he suddenly supported gay marriage. And a year and a half, 2 years later, the Supreme Court legalized it nationwide. So here you have public opinion first, then political leaders, and then the Supreme Court reversing itself on an issue. And so I think that that's the way that change, sustainable sort of permanent change on these types of issues, has to happen.
What about the sex strike, Liz? Is that how we change culture? Talk about the sex strike. Tell us the story of Alyssa Milano, Auntie Liz.
Alyssa Milano, everyone's favorite new celebrity activist gadfly, called for a sex strike in response to the George sex strike with don't have sex with Republicans, I think.
No, I don't think you're supposed to have sex with any
sex at
men.
All? Okay. Yeah. And what's just been hilarious about it is the backlash has largely been from liberals, conservatives, liberals, progressives, leftists, whatever you want to call it. But like, it's been because they're like, that's not feminist because women like sex too. Or because she said something about women having sex with men, and they were like, you should have put cis women before that, or you should have put straight women before that. And it's just, she didn't phrase her like sex strike right on Twitter, so everyone was mad.
Intersectionality strikes again.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an interesting question, right? I mean, there has for a long time been this notion that being pro-choice is an inherent part of being feminist question mark. And I think, you know, the definition of the word feminist, of course, is always in flux and always up for debate. I think it's not entirely dissimilar from a sort of longstanding notion that being a libertarian also requires you to be pro-choice on abortion. There have always been exceptions to both of those things, right? There have always been pro-life feminists. There have always been pro-life libertarians. But it certainly is hard to take seriously the sort of feminist coalition in defense of abortion when it can apparently fall apart over the lack of an appropriate prefix on, like, what is obviously a post about, like, women who have standard female reproductive organs who might, you know, accidentally get a baby in there because they have sex with someone who has standard male reproductive organs, right? Like, this should not have been a case where you needed to be careful with your wording because the context is so clear. And yet, you're right. Like, the vast majority of the quote-unquote outrage I saw was not from conservatives. It was from the intersectional
conservatives are just like, wait, we're going to ban abortion and then you're going to promote abstinence? Cool. I was like, yeah, I mean, I don't really understand.
Great day for conservatives.
Like, owned.
A-plus conservative day. Slade, could you talk a little bit about, you sort of casually referenced being Reason's token pro-life libertarian. In fact, we have a few around here. You know, I think that for people who are not all the way down in the weeds with us, the existence of that thing might come as a surprise. You know, talk about how you got where you are.
Sure. It is certainly the case that, you know, a majority of libertarians identify as pro-choice and historically have. A majority of Reason staffers have. But there are a few of us, and I anecdotally feel like that. I mean, this is not data-driven, but I think that the younger generations of libertarians are starting to skew a little bit more religious, a little bit more pro-life, which is encouraging for me from my perspective.
Confusing for me from my perspective.
Basically, the thing that I believe, which I've written for Reason before, is that libertarianism as a philosophy talks about the proper role of the state, and it talks about the protection of individual rights, but it can't actually answer the question of whether abortion is moral or immoral and whether it should be legal or not. Because in order for libertarianism to have an answer to that question, you first have answered the prior question of whether there is a second human being in the equation at the point that abortion is happening. Is the fetus a human person or not? And you can't really answer that question through libertarian first principles. You have to bring other things into the conversation. And based on where you're coming from, you're going to come to one answer or another to that. And I come to a different answer on that than I think Liz does.
Well, I was just going to say, but this is how I feel too about the question, like, can you be a pro-life feminist? Is like the same thing. I mean, like, feminism, you also, like, there's no, you know, it does not coherently answer the question of whether, you know, if you have when life begins and all these grand things and more, those are, you know, those are moral beliefs. And so people always talk about, you know, the feminism thing. And I was reading Joan Kennedy Taylor, the great libertarian feminist writer, this weekend. And, you know, she talks about how people always say, like, feminists are always contradicting themselves. She's like, feminism is a movement. And it is always, you know, different types of feminism have been dominant in it within. And, you know, there's always been disagreements within it. So I think that it's, you know, A, it's not bad that there are contradictions in it. That's actually a sign of a healthy movement, and that there's been so few contradictions. But what we think of as feminism these days is actually a sign of a not healthy movement, because it's just like one coalition dominating and just sort of shoving their version of feminism down everyone's throats. But I tend to think too that, like, if someone, you know, really, really believes that that abortion at any stage is murder, then who am I to say, like, you can't be a feminist if you believe all these other things, but you really think that we shouldn't murder people, you know? And I think that I have a bad, this is where I get, like, run into trouble with a lot of the pro-choice or whatever you want to call it movement, because, but I do think that there is room in feminist circles for that.
Well, and this is a kind of sub-variant of the intersectionality ethos, right? I mean, there is a question of, in order to be part of any movement or to sort of use a label, how much of the conventional rest of that label do you also have to participate in? And I think, you know, that's one reason that I am broadly skeptical of the idea of intersectionality, and why I think that skepticism should be applied within our movement, because there genuinely are ways to, you know, be 80% in or 90% in on, you know, things that people would say are uncontroversially feminist or libertarian, and just say, like, listen, I come to different conclusions on these other 10%, and it doesn't mean that we can't work together on, you know, stopping cops from shooting dogs.
Well, because, as you know, the confusion. Yeah, I find also a little
I feel like I shouldn't have maybe brought puppy side into our abortion discussion, and I'm sorry for that.
Also, you know, a little confused by the or find it interesting the younger, more religious anti-abortion, you know, libertarians. But I think it's because the movement's getting bigger, right? Like, it did in the, you know, in the aughts, and as we're having more people, and it's getting more diverse. You know, it's not just like a fringe group of people who all believe like these certain things. And as we have more and more people come in, we're going to have more and more different kinds of people identify with the label. And
but what that doesn't resolve, right, is, okay, what is it that we have to say either as a publication, as a movement, right, as individuals about something like this Georgia law? And I think that's, you know, to me, like, this whole conversation about movements and about labels is frankly, like, I flatter us that we are doing better than most of the country in talking about this, but it does, you know, we still do have to grapple with, like, a fundamental underlying difference, right? Like, there still is a question of just, like, what is a just law? What is a just state? Like, what does this look like as a, you know, both procedurally, but also, like, what is the end state that we can accept? And I think, you know, maybe one thing about being a libertarian is, like, we're so far from all of our desired end states that it's like, well, this is just one more thing on the list. But I don't know. I mean, Slade, do you feel like there are versions of, you know, there are versions of, like, what will happen in the next year or two that are better or worse from your perspective? Like, presumably there will be some lower court decisions that will go in for a challenge. What would your ideal scenario be from the Supreme Court, assuming that it happens in the relatively near term?
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't think that that's the right route for coming from a pro-life perspective. I think that the people who are pushing these state laws with a goal of eventually forcing the Supreme Court to rule again on this question and maybe come to a different conclusion, I mean, I understand where they're coming from. And even though I share many of their values, I just worry about this route to that end state, because I think I don't want, you know, I am a libertarian. I'm a pro-life libertarian, but I'm a libertarian. I support drug legalization, for example, in part because I look at the empirical evidence of what happens under a regime of prohibition. And I think that those lessons apply to many other things. I mean, Liz has written wonderfully about how they're currently playing out with respect to sex work. And I think that they would apply as well when it comes to the abortion issue if we ended up in a place where we had laws on the books that ran contrary to where the sort of center of gravity of public opinion in this country or in any given state is. I think we don't want to be in a place where we have criminalized things that people want and believe are good. Rather, I want to be in a place where we have persuaded people to not see those things as good.
I feel like I'm having a little bit of a galaxy brain on the fact that you're also libertarians, or you're also Reason's resident polling expert. Like, it's all coming together.
Oh, well, just no, the center of gravity kind of thing, though. I mean, because, yeah, I think if the courts do not side with, you know, the conservative position on this, like, then it could backfire, because I think if there was if somehow there got to be like a 20-week abortion ban came to court and it was somehow just, you know, weighing on that, and they're like, yes, a 20-week abortion ban across the country happened, that the center, you know, position would not really have a problem with. If you say 6-week abortion ban, I think that the vast majority, and because, I mean, this too with polling generally, I think it's different in different polls, but generally there's a lot of people who, it depends where you are in the middle, and there's
asking,
you know,
people if they're pro-life or pro-choice does not yield
right.
useful information.
So, like, that, you know, if it would just be a 6-week ban across the country or something, or in certain states, still that has more people be reactionary to it than otherwise.
And yet, most of the country disagrees with us on most things. So this is, I think, the other question for, you know, I agree that the practical political way forward here is to think about cultural change, to think about the diffuse decision-making. But in fact, if we say, like, well, listen, there's something morally relevant or something sort of something that has real weight in, like, where is the middle of the road public opinion on issue X? Like, what are we doing with the rest of our time?
It's not moral. It's pragmatic, right? It's whether or not the legal regime can survive or will lead to really bad, worse unintended consequences, I think.
Okay. So it's actually a utilitarian and pragmatic calculus that y'all are proposing,
and I think,
alongside,
like,
the moral one.
The feminist side, or the side arguing for abortion access, should be more sort of cognizant of this too, because also it's very much in, you know, have lots of successes in court with getting these laws struck down as unconstitutional. But there is not a huge network outside of especially like one, you know, centralized thing like Planned Parenthood or something like that, that, you know, that are working to have different solutions. Like, what if abortion, you know, is banned? How do we get low income people from out of state to go here? How do we make it easier for people to get pills online? Like all of that sort of stuff. Like, it's been very much like, we're going to challenge the laws. Republicans are bad. Planned Parenthood is good. That's it. That's sort of been the be all end all for like 20 years of the pro-choice side strategy. So I think, yeah, there should be more like getting in there on the ground sort of too from that side.
And if I may, the sort of pro-abortion side has made the same mistake that I'm describing right now, the potential mistake, or, you know, what I think might end up being a mistake that's happening on the pro-life side, which is with these recent bills in Rhode Island, the New York one that actually passed, and the Virginia one that created a huge controversy, though not nearly as big a one as it probably should have because it was overshadowed by the Virginia governor in blackface. But
2019.
but basically, the sort of pushing too far, pushing way out beyond where the center of gravity in terms of public opinion is happening on both sides. And in some cases, it's being done intentionally, you know, again, because they're trying to move the Overton window. They're trying to, you know, get to back to the Supreme Court, whatever the case may be. But I mean, people are, when you sit down, and I've done this because I did work in the public opinion research field before I came to Reason. When you sit down in a room and have a focus group with voters, even once I did this with women voters who identify as strongly pro-choice, they still are horrified by the idea that you would that you would assume that means that they are in favor of third trimester abortion, for example. And likewise, when you talk to people who are pro-life, they often get very uncomfortable with the idea of a law that would stop somebody from having an abortion if there were some sort of a serious fetal abnormality, or in the case of rape in many cases. So the positions are really blurry, even among people who would describe themselves as one thing or the other. I do think that there's a reason that this 6 weeks or you know, heartbeat has become the new line, demarcating line on the pro-life side, and that is because there is an intuitive reaction that people have to the idea of, once that there's a beating heart in a woman's womb, that suggests that there's another human person present. I think they're not wrong. When you talk to people, they do intuitively react to that. But then, now when you then say, but do you think that we should throw women in jail? You know,
well, also that comes, like, there's science issues there too, though. Like, I've already seen this big fight, like, between like all these people pulling out different doctors on both sides saying like, yes, that is analogous to a heartbeat, and other people saying like, no, that's just like actually like fetal cardiac activity at that thing isn't even like anything, and blah, blah, blah. So I think, like, I know, I kind of thought like, well, I've heard people be like, this is going to get us around all the weird science questions with viability issues,
no,
but like, definitely. Not at all.
No, I think Slade is right. Like, the place where that's happening is on the intuitive and emotional level. It doesn't resolve anything on a kind of bright line scientific level, because there's lots of debate about what even the science of that sound is on the Doppler when you're listening. So one question I want to ask you guys, just kind of to project out into an alternate future, is, Liz, you've done a lot of coverage about over-the-counter birth control and the, I think it's fair to say, like, the perversion of the use of the word access to mean subsidy, or even, you know, totally like, you know, government provided
or employer provided
So let's talk for a minute about, you know, I think right now the general sense in the country is that we are not headed in this direction. But if we were headed in the direction of expanded abortion access, where is the point where even pro-choice libertarians have to part ways with the, you know, Planned Parenthood and others who would surely lobby for subsidized or even just like government-provided abortions, which would then require Stephanie Slade to pay for your abortion, hopefully not directly and personally.
That line already has been crossed already in certain states where they're, you know, passing laws that, and it's so terrible, because like all the laws that have good and bad parts, you know, it's like they're passing a law that says, okay, like if Roe v. Wade is overturned or whatever, like, you know, we have in our state constitution that abortion access is a right. Okay. And then they'll say, and also it needs to be funded by like this and this. I mean, there's already this intertwining that makes it really hard, like on the health insurance and on the alt, you know, birth control, and on so many issues for libertarian anti-discrimination laws. Like, there's so much where it's just like, yes, no, yes, no.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's something that I think about, is all of the rhetoric around abortion access, like a logical place that it will go for people who don't have priors about forcing people to pay for each other's services.
Well, And an interesting thing, just because you brought that up, is in the Georgia case, you know, if this law would stand, it defines people at embryos at 6 weeks as natural born persons that have all the rights. And so they would be able to, you know, be eligible for, you know, a woman who is 6 weeks pregnant would be eligible for child support. You know, there's tax deductions for parents of unborn children. There'd be, you know, concerns with the birthright citizenship so there's just all these different things too, where it's creating these new sort of categories.
Yeah.
That are complicated from a libertarian standpoint.
Yeah. No, that's true. I hadn't actually thought about the what state are you born in if in Georgia you're born when you're negative 32 weeks old or 34 weeks old.
I mean, some of this can actually be resolved with just legislative language. I mean, the word birth can have a definition that means birth.
and yet, weirdly, it seems like we're moving away from that.
Yes, Slade, what does gender mean?
Yeah.
This is words are no problem. Confusing in 2019.
So I think just as a kind of a closing note, I'm interested to hear what both of you think about more broadly about what, if anything, the libertarian way of thinking can bring to this debate, which is so broken. Like the fact that everyone has just been shouting at each other for a week and that the solution seemed to be like Hollywood's not making any movies in Georgia and there's a sex strike, and also, you know, just like the sort of broad-based inability, I think, in this country to talk about abortion in a calm and reasonable way. Do you think there are any rubrics in the way that you guys think about this question as libertarians that, if brought into the broader conversation, could like help resolve what seems irresolvable? So I'm asking you, can you solve like the most broken piece of rhetoric in America? Liz, let's start with you. Like, is there a way of thinking and talking about this that you think people are overlooking that might help bridge this gap?
I mean, the only thing I've settled on is because, I hate talking about abortion just because, I hate the way that either side argues about it. And I just think, you know, the mainstream on either side of this is so flawed. So, but what I've sort of settled on, I guess, so far has been pushing for things like over-the-counter birth control and things like that. Because, I mean, like, that is a huge one that, for some reason, you know, I mean, for a long time, conservatives didn't want to talk about it. And then when they started talking about it, the Democrats don't want to talk about it. And so, I don't know, I've focused on things like that. And I think when, you know, with abortion, I've been talking to more about like pills and like, you know, like internet things and stuff, because I think these are the areas where, like, both in prevention and in, you know, medical abortion. But those are kind of the things where you can bridge some stuff and at least talk about that, and I just sort of that's not a good
answer. The technological
answer.
Landscape is changing, people's views might not be quite as often.
Yeah, which I think is like a very reasony thing. You know, like we always try to talk about where science can overcome political or social sort of problems. And this isn't quite one, but I think just because nobody really talks about those areas, at least that's one area where I just, you know, I don't want to be shouted into the void too. Like, this is why I don't write about abortion as much as you know, maybe would otherwise, just because that's being covered so much. And there are so many other issues that I think of as women's issues or reproductive issues that are not being covered. So I try to focus on those because I think we're oversaturated in the abortion debate landscape. But
yeah, I don't have a really satisfying answer to this. One thing I was thinking about, though, is that as libertarians, we tend to be more focused on intellectual consistency and keeping the first principles front of mind. And, you know, I think the reason that I can sit here in this room with you two, my two colleagues who disagree with me completely on this issue, and we can have a civil conversation and, you know, walk out friends at the end of it, is because we know that we know what we all believe and why, and we are reasoning from those beliefs. And so, for example, when the ACLU sues a Catholic hospital to try to force that Catholic hospital to do abortions, I trust that you guys, when I make an argument for why from libertarian principles you should be on, you know, against that, I trust that you're not going to just scream at me for being, you know, anti-woman and kick me out of the movement, like, and vice versa. You know, when I see overreach, which I often do, you know, people that agree with me on things who then want, I mean, this is not abortion, but the recent religious liberty rules that were handed down by the Trump administration were great in many ways, but of course, but then I was reading through them and I thought, like, oh, they're overstepping. They don't just want to protect people of faith; they want to punish people who disagree. Right? There's there's often on both sides a lot of that going on. And but because we sort of are coming from clear-eyed understanding of what our values and beliefs are, we're kind of able to transcend a lot of those temptations, like baser temptations. And I don't know how I don't have a lot of hope that that's going to be that we're going to be able to spread that to the wider population. But I mean, I'm really proud that we can at least be hopefully an example.
Yeah,
of it.
And I hope that libertarians more broadly can too, because I mean, there's very, you know, especially on places like Twitter and stuff. But like, I mean, there's a lot of shouting, and it's upsetting that we're not being better.
Be better is our takeaway. Thank you very much, Elizabeth Nolan Brown, Stephanie Slade, for the Reason podcast. I am Catherine Mangy Ward.